In the dream of fiction, we create characters and settings. We do it through a variety of means. And today we have two videos by Susanna Daniel and Marcus Burke, who give us some ideas about how to think about dialogue, voice, and place. Susanna Daniel was the author of two novels, Stiltsville and Sea Creatures.
And Marcus Burke is the author of the novel Team 7, and he's also a heck of a good basketball player. And both our writers are graduates of the Iowa Writers' Workshop. Marcus is talking a lot about place and dialogue, and Susanna is talking about dialogue and setting and how to pull setting through. So you're going to have an opportunity to think about the function of setting in as an active component in the writing of fiction.
Enjoy.
I'm Susanna Daniel. I'm the author of two novels, both of which are set in South Florida, and setting is a really big part of what I do as a writer. And something that interested me in writing my first novel, Stiltsville, was how setting can pull through a novel in the same way that a character or a plot line is pulled through a narrative. So a setting like mine, which is houses out in Biscayne Bay, almost becomes a character of, in and of itself, and can enrich a story. And also, I think a lot about how the absence of a fully realized setting can really be a detriment to a story and leave something kind of ineffectual or cold on the page. So I like to talk about setting because I think it's often badly taught in schools. It's usually prescribed as sort of one of a triangle, character, plot, setting, whereas actually I think setting should be thought of more as background for plot and character and sort of entwined with both of those. And then we also add sort of theme and point of view into that mix. So these are all important technical choices that a writer makes on the page when beginning or revising a work, but they're not three independent elements. They work together to enhance meaning. And without setting, I just don't think that any narrative is as fulfilled as it can be. In other words, sometimes we talk about fiction as if it's like an improv exercise where we, you know, throw somebody up on stage and we say, you know, here's your setting, here's your character, here's a line of dialogue, go. And actually, I think setting should never, ever be considered that way. A setting in fiction has much more meaning than setting in real life. And that's true of so much on the page, including dialogue. There's an oft-quoted line in the John Updike story, Twin Beds in Rome, about the divorcing couple passing by the Colosseum in the back of a taxi cab, thinking that the Colosseum resembles a ruined wedding cake. So that's sort of the perfect way of thinking about setting and what it can bring to the page. It's an image that works. It's a setting detail that works on three levels. So it's visually resonant, it's thematically resonant, and it's psychologically resonant. So it enhances, the reader can visualize it, of course, but it also enhances the meaning of the story and the psychology of the characters. So I'd like to talk about this idea that setting detail or a metaphor should resonate on more than one level at a time by looking very closely at Robert Stone's really great story, Under the Pitons. Which is kind of a classic mini-epic in which the main character is a tragic hero named Blessington, who is piloting this sailboat along with three other people, and they're running drugs, and they're looking to offload them in St. Lucia. And they stop just off the coast under the twin peaks of the Pitons, the two peaks of the Pitons. And all of the events in the present action of the story take place on this sailboat or just off of it. And Blessington is in charge of driving the boat, but the leader of the pack is this unhinged, coke-addled French guy, who we call the Frenchman also has a name, and he possibly intends to throw them overboard. And also with them is another woman named Marie, and more importantly, a brainy, body, beautiful Texan named Jillian. So obviously this setting is very, very important to what the events that unfold in the story. But because there's so much money on the line, and we know that from the beginning that Blessington, our tragic hero, wants to use the money to study business management and open a restaurant in the Keys, which is like one of those desires on the part of a character that's like realistic enough to make it kind of heartbreaking that you know from the beginning that's never going to happen. But it also characterizes him as like kind of modestly ambitious in a really appealing way. So we're rooting for him, even though he's drunk through the whole story. And in the middle, he decides that he's falling a little in love with Jillian. And yeah, there's a lot of danger in the story, both in the past of the story, the present of the story, and then as we find out in the future. And basically, the peaks of the Pitons are only mentioned 5 or 6 times in the story, but they change in character each time that, that Robert Stone brings them onto the page. So they're foggy when they first come into view. And then as the boat tacks closer and Blessington gets closer to this, to realizing this dream of offloading these drugs, getting what he wants, they become clearer and distinct from one another. And when he, when Blessington and Jillian are kind of pretending to fall in love or hoping to fall in love with each other, they are the green mountains in the full richness of the afternoon rose above them as if they are sort of majestic and lovely and not dangerous at all. And then when Blessington thinks that he might love her even more, the shadow of the peaks spread over the water as if the shore and all of its promise are coming to him instead of the other way around. And then a little while later, after the Frenchman shows that he's capable of getting them all killed, the Pitons looked close enough to strike with a rock and the rich jungle smell came out of the wind. So we get sort of a touch and a smell off of these still distance mountains. They become realer to Blessington as the possibility of reaching them becomes less likely. He's seen them before, but now he can smell them and feel them. And then just after the tension of the story culminates and the reader knows exactly what's going to happen and what's going to be the downfall of these people, Blessington can see the great, great green tower of Gros Piton shining like Jacob's ladder itself, thrusting toward the empty blue of the cloudless sky. And at this point, the Pitons not only fully differentiate from each other, but the Grand Peak resembles a ladder to heaven, harbor in every sense of the word, and it becomes like the physical embodiment of everything that's at stake on the page. So this is, I mean, Robert Stone is obviously making setting work really hard in the story. He's doing 3 things. It's pushing the characters to make choices they might not otherwise make. Without the Pitons in the near distance, Blessington might not have been inspired to fight his fate, and what he eventually does is swim to shore. And the Frenchman might not have made the bad choice to stop the boat there, which results in their downfall. The setting adds to the story's tension by being described dynamically on the page by changing as the light changes and the day changes. And growing in stature and detail and tangibility as the climax builds. And it reflects back emotions like loyalty and resentment and affection onto the characters as those characters are feeling those things. And I should note that the Pitons aren't the only setting for the story. The boat is also described in sort of operational detail, just enough to get us on the boat, but not enough to get us to like pilot it, which is something I think is important to note. And all of the setting, I mean, all of the action takes place in basically like a 20-foot square area, which is just to say that a setting is very important, but it doesn't have to be a grand setting. It doesn't have to make an enormous statement as long as it's described thoughtfully and in detail. And those details are chosen with an eye to enhancing character and enhancing meaning. The other thing that I want to say about setting that people sometimes forget is that era is included in setting. So something like, Ann Patchett said recently, or she wrote recently, that she doesn't like having cell phones in stories because they sort of kill forward action. They remove mystery. Well, what does that mean? I can just look it up. Where is that thing? I can just find it. So she's in State of Wonder. She has her character lose her cell phone several times. Era is working against her in that way, against the author. And then I was thinking also of this great book called The Cape Ann by a Midwestern writer named Faith Sullivan. And in it, a 12-year-old girl, it's Depression era, and in it a 12-year-old girl becomes very good friends with a middle-aged man she meets in the middle of the day in a bar. So having a 12-year-old character meet a middle-aged man in the middle of the day in a bar is problematic, except in the Depression era, and that's sort of on the page as well, because you know, a lot of really respectable men are out of work, and this is a place where they come to be together, and it's community, and it's just one way in which era really plays a part in setting. So to finish up, I will just repeat or reiterate that setting in fiction is imbued with much more meaning than it is in real life. Some of us, I think, probably wish our settings were imbued with more meaning, but they're not. And then the exercise that I like to accompany whenever I talk to students about setting is a dialogue exercise, actually. And Under the Pitons is a really good a story to read, not just in terms of setting, but in terms of snappy dialogue and moving characterization forward and changing attitudes on the page just through dialogue. And even technical choices like attributions and tags and stuff, really nicely done and quickly done in Robert Stone's work, and in particular Under the Pitons. So what I like to have students do when I talk about setting is write a 2 to 3 page scene. Can occur any time in the arc of a story. But they have to, each character on the page has to have at least 5 lines of dialogue, and something has to change or be revealed, or some misunderstanding must be clarified on the page. And then I like to have them write the scene, then rewrite it in a particular setting with a Robert Stone-like eye to setting detail, then rewrite it again with a totally different setting. So if it's on a boat, then the next time it's in an office building, something like that, a completely different setting, and just see how you can bring in sensory detail to your setting and meaning to your characterization and to your themes using setting detail.
Hi, my name is Marcus Burke, and I'm the author of Team 7, which is coming out on Doubleday Books, 2014. And today I wanted to talk about character, voice, and place, and how I think it's very hard to compartmentalize those things and separate them, because I think when writing organically, I think that comes from like a subconscious state. So I think, for me at least, before I sit down to write, I have to have a general idea of what the story is. And that's why I think before you actually find that vein to kind of write yourself into that, I think sometimes the most helpful thing to do is to identify the place, the character, and what voice would suit this type of story. And I think those are very strongly hinged on each other, because in my novel, I based it in the neighborhood that I grew up in. So I very well knew exactly the place, the kind of place that I was dealing with, and the way that the people would speak in this kind of place. So I didn't have to question whether this voice was authentic. I think sometimes the thing that's more important to question is whether you're overwriting. But I think sometimes it's harder to know authenticity if you're not necessarily involved with a specific group of people. And I think that takes a little more imagining, but I think on a base level, once you know the place and the character, then the voice just kind of rises out of that. Because, for instance, I have a character in my novel that, my novel is set, and it's about a first generation young man named Andre Battle, and he is living in Milton, Massachusetts, which is a quasi suburb town on the edge of Boston, and he's living with his Costa Rican and Jamaican grandparents and his reggae artist father and his Costa Rican mother. And these are very, very different sets of voices that are going to be in the house, and they're going to be a different set of sensibilities where, for instance, you know, the grandfather is a Costa Rican and Jamaican man, so a lot of times when he's angry, he doesn't speak of violence in the same terms that maybe an American would speak of violence, like, I'm going to hit you or I'm going to do something. You know, he's more like, I would hit him and make him fall like a bird out of the sky. You know, and that's because his sensibilities are more in working in the country where he originates, whereas, you know, the drug dealers on the corner would be quicker to talk about using guns and things of that nature, because that's more of an American sensibility. And I think that the characters were all, I think that the characters in the way that they interact with each other, that's where some of the story starts to emerge, I think. Because if you're not 100% sure of, like, you know, okay, so now you know these people, you know how they talk, and you can even have a voice of how you want to put it down. But I think then the thing is now, what's the story? And I feel like I constantly ask myself, what's the story? What's the story? And I think that the best way to find the story is to allow yourself to roam around with a character you know in a place that you're familiar with. Because I think that the stimuli that's around you is going to enable you to start to think of stories, or, you know, it's almost like seeing an old friend where you probably wouldn't have thought of that story unless this old friend came around and was like, you remember that time? And so I think that, you know, for example, in the beginning of my novel, growing up, there was a group of guys that would hang out on the corner all the time, and, you know, they would have water balloon fights and stuff like that. And the name of my novel is Team Seven, and my mother was indeed very strict, and she wouldn't allow me to go and hang on the corner with those guys because she was just like, you out of your mind. And so one thing that I was doing was I was away at school, and I was reminiscing on just kind of like the summer days when, like, you know, everybody was just out. And then I started wondering, like, you know, why do these guys call themselves Team 7? Because this was a group of guys, and I was like, well, why do they call themselves that? And for the life of me, I couldn't figure it out. And so I took kind of two ideas. You know, one, what would it have been like if my mother had indeed actually let me run with those guys? And then I think, you know, a motivation like how did they get their name can allow you to start to play with some fiction. And I think that it all kind of culminated in the setting of this neighborhood, because this kid's very well in his, he's in his walkway, and he's watching these guys on the corner, and a rap battle breaks out. And, you know, that's something that would very often happen in my neighborhood, because, you know, I came up during the era when gangster rap was starting to become prevalent. And so, you know, all the guys wanted to be rappers, you know, I mean, a lot of guys still do, but anyhow, a freestyle battle broke out, and the, you know, the leader of this group on the corner wins the battle. And so a couple of days later, the guy comes back and he wants to fight. He doesn't want to battle anymore, and he has a group of guys with him that, you know, now he has a group of guys, there's another group of guys, so there's a brawl happening, and this kid is watching all of this happen from his walkway. And in a sense, my question would have been like, you know, how did this kid, like, what would it have been like for him to run with them? But at the same time, I had to find an end for him. Like, well, how would a little kid fall in with a group of older guys that are very much not concerned with little kid things? And so the fight is happening, and one guy is getting away from, like, kind of the main guy in this crew, and this little kid's dribbling his basketball in the walkway. Guy's running right at him, and so he's dribbling, takes his ball, he winds up his leg, and he hucks it right at the guy's face. And knocks the guy down, and, I mean, the kid gets terrified, because, I mean, I think in most situations, it's like all fun and games until it happens, and then you're like, uh-oh, I could get in trouble now. So the kid runs in the house, and he's running in the house, and then he's like, oh my God, what if that guy saw my face? What's going to happen? And I think that's kind of where place comes back into it, because it wasn't the kind of neighborhood that somebody was going to call the cops about a fight. And it wasn't the type of neighborhood that, like, these guys were going to let some outsiders come picking on a little kid. And so the kid goes back to the door to look outside to see what's going on. And his basketball is sitting on the doormat waiting for him. Everybody's gone. And I think, in a sense, that kind of gets at, like, you know, the kind of characters that live here and the kind of place that this is. Because, you know, if you take the template of what happened and you impose it into another place with different characters, that could go very differently. You know, for instance, I remember when I got to private school, I came from a public school. I was recruited to go from public school to private school for basketball. And when I got to private school, you were no longer allowed to fight in school. Where in public school, that was a 3-day suspension, no big deal. But then you get to private school and it's like, fighting, like, this is higher education, we don't do that here. And I think that's where knowing your characters is most vital, because I don't think that dynamic characters are necessarily always consistent, but I think that the motivations behind what they're doing manifest in a consistent way, rather. And so I think that kind of when you wrap all of those things together, I think more than, like, character, place, and voice, I think that those are things that hinge on each other, but I don't know, at least when I'm making a draft of anything, I think that the grander goal is to find a story, but to get an emotional truth. Because I think that voice, style, all that stuff is, I guess I would say on a grander level, aesthetic is not universal. I think that everywhere beauty is different. I think everywhere has different customs. But I think the one thing that is universal is emotion. Because regardless of how a culture or a sect of people deal with any given life event, everybody can empathize with an emotion. Everybody knows what it's like to be sick. Everybody knows what it's like to be hurt, mad, angry, all of those things.
This week's assignment is about voice and place. So what we'd like you to do is to think about a place you know, think about the people from there, think about the rhythm of their conversation, accents, just the way they talk and the way they occupy their environment. And in a short assignment, no more than 400 words, please, we'd like you to write a scene in which you bring character and setting together, remembering that people make place and places make people.
And think about these two writers we have here, Susanna writing about Florida, Marcus writing about Boston. They talk so differently in each of these places. Peter Matheson's wonderful Shadow Country, he said he wanted so much to get the inflections of the country talk that the people had in the Everglades in Florida. That's what we want. Combine those inflections, that tone of voice, and that place, make the scene come to life.